Good evening and welcome to Thursday's Late Debate. Joining us here in Studio 10 tonight, we have Róisín Shortall, co-leader of the Social Democrats and spokesperson on health, Fianna Fáil Senator Lisa Chambers, Shannon spokesperson on foreign and European affairs, Independent TD for Kildare South, Cathal Berry. In a nearby studio, we have Mick Clifford, special correspondent with the Irish Examiner, and in our Sligo studio, Dr. Fergal Hickey, consultant in emergency medicine in Sligo University Hospital and spokesperson for the Irish Association for Emergency Medicine. We want to hear from you, so do please get in touch. You can text us on 51551. You can email latedebate@rte.ie or you can tweet at latedebate.rte. Now, of course, in the last few hours, Donegal has been moved to level 3 restrictions while the situation around the country is continuing to evolve and deteriorate. Here is Taoiseach Micheál Martin from the press briefing earlier this evening.
Tonight's decision is based on, frankly, very worrying data provided by NPHET. Over the last 7 days, Donegal's 7-day incidence rate of infection is more than anywhere else in the country. Clusters are growing throughout the county, and as one example, we've established tonight that in one local district area, Stranraer LEA, we're looking at an infection rate of 336 per 100,000.
Business people from Donegal spoke to Drive Time as the news of the new restrictions broke this evening.
You know, we never really got going in June whenever we reopened. We closed on the 14th of March and reopened on the 9th of June. There's still a lot of fear around. Everybody up here has known this has been coming for the last 2 or 3 weeks.
We only opened our doors at 12 o'clock yesterday, and now we've been told we're closing at 12, so it's half 11 tonight. We've lost the last 6 months, the best part of the year. A lot of them are going to turn around and say, no, we're not going to bother till coming up to St. Patrick's Day again next year. They won't even bother up in January or February.
And that was business people very downhearted for obvious reasons there in Donegal this evening. Dr. Fergal Hickey, if I can go to you first, you're up there in the northwest in Sligo University Hospital. Did you see this coming? Was this apparent that we were going to get here on the ground?
Yes, I think so. I think the reality is that most of COVID in Donegal is in North Donegal. It's in the general area of Letterkenny and the Finn Valley. More than in South Donegal. Many patients from South Donegal would come to Sligo University Hospital for their services, but we as a hospital have not seen a large number of COVID-positive patients requiring hospital admission. But my understanding from my colleagues in public health is that many of the cases in Donegal are due to family contacts. So a person gets COVID wherever and transmits it to their family, and then various people in that family go to various social events and they in turn transmit it to other people. So if there had been better adherence to the public health advice, then this outbreak would not have happened in the way that it has. And it is predominantly in young people.
Yeah,
but I think we've been expecting it for a while.
Yeah, that's the statistic kind of jumped out at us. A quarter of all cases in Donegal in the 15 to 24 age group in the last couple of weeks. Do you get the sense, Fergal Hickey, that these people, this age group, still think they're invincible despite all the public health messages?
Yes, and part of that is that, you know, they may well be asymptomatic or have very limited symptoms, not dissimilar to a common cold. And as far as they're concerned, they're fine and they're in a position to do what they normally do. I think it's very difficult to convince people who feel well or feel very, only very limited way unwell, that they need to do something different than their normal. What they forget is that they may well transmit it to family members or friends or other people in their community who may be much more vulnerable, and maybe the very group who require hospital admission subsequently or intensive care admission or sadly may in fact die. And I think if they were to know somebody who had COVID and ended up in an intensive care unit, you'd find a very different response. I think complacency has certainly set in.
Yeah, I do think, I've often thought that actually it's the personal stories that really we know impact with people, that really make an impression on people, and perhaps we should be going down that road instead of just kind of generally telling people try and, you know, half your contacts.
Absolutely, and I think we also need to communicate with this age group in through media that they understand. The public health pronouncements that are made at the Department of Health briefing on a nightly basis and may well be carried on national media don't necessarily get through to them. I think we need to look at other ways of doing it. I think there's also, I mean, I've certainly heard of examples where people who are contacts of somebody with COVID or who have symptoms and have had a COVID test and are waiting for the result have not limited their social activities. And I think that is particularly worrying. I mean, if you have symptoms or if you're a close contact of somebody and you are awaiting the result of your test, you are obliged to limit your social activities and not risk transmitting this to other people. But that has gone on pretty much unrestricted in much of Donegal. And, you know, from talking to people in the area, this is common knowledge.
Yeah, but I suppose that does then feed into something we will talk about maybe a little later in the programme, is the speed of the turnaround times for testing and tracing. I just want to go to you, Cathal Berry, though, now, because obviously Kildare was that soldier not too long ago, and you're still on, you're now on the watch list again. But you did, the numbers came down, the lockdown came, the numbers came down, Kildare opened up again. But if it's just going to lead to another shutdown very quickly, I mean, is that sustainable?
Well, yeah, just good evening, Katie. So my constituency, Kildare South, it actually covers Laois and Offaly as well. So I suppose you could argue that I could speak a bit more credibility than most people that have lived through the three lockdowns in the Midlands. Look, it was a big hit for local business, for sure, and a big hit for the public. But those suppression and containment strategies did work, particularly in Laois and Offaly. Now, Kildare was slightly different. So Laois and Offaly did 2 weeks of restrictions. Kildare did an additional 12 days on top of that.
And apart from the restaurants, you know, closing down indoor dining and the pubs and all that, did people that you're aware, did they change how they behaved? Just regular, you know, everyday people. Did they actually stop going to each other's houses? Was there did you detect a big change in how people were going about their business every day?
Yeah, I definitely detected a big change. People were fantastic. They were incredible. There was a huge reduction in people's social activities and huge reduction in the amount of traffic even on the road. So the restrictions, despite all their imperfections, and there are two large motorways going through County Kildare, they did have an effect and they did actually work. And when we're looking at the Kildare numbers creeping up again, I think it's important to remember that the initial lockdown period was as a result of outbreaks in meat factories and in direct provision centres. The more recent numbers creeping up, it's pretty much in the northeastern part of the county, which is very close to Dublin. So it's probably a proximity.
It's the dopes that are doing it, Cathal. It's not good Kildare people at all.
I couldn't possibly comment on that one.
Okay. Roisin, you know, obviously, listening to the Taoiseach this evening, a very grave situation that we've arrived at again. And, you know, today it's Donegal's problem. And obviously there's all those other counties who may hear the same news in the next few days. Can we go on like this?
Well, first of all, we have to do what the government announced tonight. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the speed and the growth of the figures in Donegal is absolutely shocking, that it could happen so quickly and, you know, that the virus could take such a hold in such a short space of time. So, I mean, lockdowns do work. There's no doubt about that. Previous ones, the national one, worked. We got the figures down. We got them down very low over the summer months. And hopefully we will do the same again. And I think there's lots of points to be made there about messaging. You know, I think there's certainly a high level of complacency. I think people are just kind of weary and kind of aren't as enthusiastic about compliance. I also think the point that Dr. Hickey made is a very important one. You know, those of us that kind of follow the news and read the newspapers and are doing this stuff in our daily job, that's all very well. But there's lots of people who don't hear that conversation or don't hear the messages. And the Taoiseach last weekend alluded to the possibility of, you know, using influencers on social media. And I thought that was a very good idea. And I spoke to him during the week in the Dáil and encouraged him to do that. But I think we also need influencers, not just for young people, but for all different age cohorts and for people with different interests, whether that's sport or, you know, music or whatever, and indeed for different ethnic cohorts as well. You have to tailor the message. And I think an awful lot more could be done in that regard. So, look, we have to comply, and we certainly should be doing everything we can to encourage people to comply very closely with the restrictions, because that is our only choice at this stage. There is no other plan. And we have to, if we want to save lives and save our livelihoods and our well-being and all of that. Having said that, we cannot continue, you know, responding to every upsurge with a lockdown or a close down like that. It's not sustainable. There are other factors to life, work, socialising.
Yeah, listening to those business people.
All of those people.
Yeah.
And you're like, I am not scoring any points at the moment or attempting to do that. But what I did ask the Taoiseach during the week was to reflect on, you know, whether this is the right strategy to pursue. Because this strategy of suppressing the virus was very much based on having a really fast, responsive testing and tracing system. We've never really achieved that, regrettably, over the last 7 months. And that's not enough anyway. And we need to look at other possibilities, like how do we identify where the virus is being transmitted?
So the only way to do that is contact testing, testing and contact tracing.
And proper tracing.
Yeah.
And I mean, we discovered last weekend on your programme on Saturday, you know, that we're not doing that kind of thorough tracing. We're doing the 48-hour tracing, yeah, which identifies close contacts. But we're not doing the 5 or 6 day tracing, which identifies where the virus is actually being transmitted. So is it on flights? Is it, you know, in restaurants? Is it in bars? Is it in sports clubs? We don't really have any handle on that. And if we were doing more thorough tracing, we could get that.
Yeah. Lisa, isn't that a very good point that we're not? We were told, oh, go back to March and April. There was a lot of speeches made about hunting down this virus, and this is how we were going to deal with it. But we're not hunting it down. We're you know, catching up with it at all times.
Like it's an impossible balance to strike. It really is. On one hand, I mean, at the outset in March, when it was new for, you know, for all of its woes, it's a very simple message to communicate. Everything's closed. Stay at home. We're in lockdown. That we don't know what's happening. We'll come back to you. That was it. It's very simple to communicate that message. At the time, people were very scared, and you know, they said, right, we'll do this. It's 2 weeks initially. It might be a third week. Next thing, it's a month. Might be 2 months. We're 6 months in now. We know a lot more about the virus, but we still don't know enough about it. COVID fatigue is definitely there. People are frustrated. They've had enough.
I know, but respond to the point that Roisin made there in relation to our, how we are not doing the level of contact tracing that would help us to discover really where this is spreading. We're making assumptions about where it's spreading because we're only going back a couple of days in terms of the amount of contact tracing we're able to do. And yeah, surely that's something we could do as a you know, that we're not relying on every single man, woman and child in the country to do something. This is something that should be put in place.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I think extra contact tracing and increased, I suppose, frequency of that will be a good thing. But you're relying then on people's memories, which is imperfect. You're relying on people complying with the requests, which again is imperfect. It's not the perfect solution. I think you have to always hold in your back pocket the ability. You kind of have to hold in your back pocket the ability to have localised lockdowns. They're not ideal. They're not something that anybody welcomes.
But you can't continue with those indefinitely. Like that, it just is not sustainable. Won't keep people with you.
Want to listen to...
Hear your point in that, but what's the alternative?
Well, can I just play you? We had Professor Emer Shelley on this programme last night. She's the Dean of the Public Health Faculty in the Royal College of Physicians. And I asked her specifically about this issue, about how much can we do, what is being done out there by the public health specialists, because they are the people who are in charge of this end of things. And here's what she told me.
I advocated really from the end of May or certainly in June for a temporary increase in staff while more permanent staff were being recruited, because there was a real need for stability as well as capacity in public health departments. Some staff have been recruited, but it's not sufficient. I have to say some outbreaks are being fully investigated and linked back to the original source, but there isn't capacity for all of them.
You see, this is the key problem, I think, in terms of how we're approaching this. We are not actually finding out, because we're giving out general public health advice, are we not? But in some cases, that doesn't apply. So for Waterford, we discovered this week that a third of the cases in Waterford could be linked back to the meat plant in Waterford. But, you know, that is the kind of information we need to really... But the whole of Waterford may get shut down because of that.
Yeah, but I think, you know, quicker contact tracing, absolutely. I just don't think it's the silver bullet, unfortunately.
But nobody said it's a silver bullet, but surely to God it's part of the arsenal we should have. Yeah. And we had a whole summer to put it in place and we didn't.
I've got three fingers coming at me at all sides here. So I think in terms of the contact tracing, yes, absolutely. We need to do more of that. We need to get better at doing it. The difficulty, I don't know, I'm not a public health expert, but if you're looking at somebody having contracted the virus somewhere in the community, then it takes a couple of days for maybe symptoms to show. It is a little bit difficult to expect somebody to say, well, here's where I was 5 days ago. Here's who I met. That's the imperfection
of it. Surely the approach, Lisa, should be about managing risk. I mean, the only way you can avoid risk is by hibernating. OK, and people aren't prepared to do that, nor would it be desirable. So what you need to do then is to assess the risk of contracting the virus in different settings. Mm-hmm. And then you balance that risk. Mm-hmm. And like you balance that against people being able to earn livelihoods, to meet their elderly parents, to, you know, go to school, all of those things. But at the moment, we don't have the expertise working on this in order to assess the relative levels of risk involved in different activities and therefore strike a balance. And that's a fundamental problem in the
approach
to it.
I actually disagree with you. I think the best minds in the country are working on this. Well, I actually think it's an impossible balance to actually strike.
Fergus, do you want to get in there?
Yeah, just I suppose Fergus. I need to make the observation that the infrastructure for dealing with many of these problems is actually pretty threadbare. So the public health service in the country hasn't really changed over many years and has had to manage nothing like we've ever seen in recent months, ever in the past. And it doesn't have the capacity to be ramped up quickly or efficiently. Now, there was a lot of people that were redeployed from other HSE roles into public health to support them. But the infrastructure is pretty threadbare. And it's better in some places than in others, and that might explain why contact tracing is more complete in some parts of the country than others. And this problem with infrastructure, and no doubt we'll talk about it when we talk about the winter plan, pervades all aspects of healthcare in the country, where we're working with legacy systems which really haven't kept pace with the needs of 2020. And I think that needs to be acknowledged.
Lisa, you were disagreeing with... Roisin there.
Well, the point about making that this idea that you can strike the perfect balance between reopening the economy, getting people back to work, but also keeping the virus sufficiently suppressed to save
lives.
Nobody said
it's perfect, but it is about balancing.
Of course, it's about balance, but to try and find that balance, the balancing point is moving all of the time. That's the problem. Nobody wants to close down the economy fully, and we're not doing that. The intention is to open up as much as possible. And that's why you have localised knockdowns and not nationwide lockdowns. And that's why we're trying to gather data in each area. And even down to municipal district level, actually in Dublin, I mean, that data was published. But that balance is moving, it is shifting. It's a difficult one to strike. I think anybody suggests, no country in the world has found this perfect balance. No country. So to suggest that we're somehow different in that regard, I just don't agree with that.
Okay, can I get, I just want, I'll bring you in a minute, Carl, but I want to bring Mick Clifford in. Mick?
Yeah, Katie, just in relation to the lockdown, and I mean, there's no question, I think, as Fergal said, in terms of the threadbare nature of public health infrastructure. But in terms of the buy-in from people, I mean, if you take somebody in Donegal, for instance, who's in Ballyshannon or Donegal Town, who is a cafe, who now realises they have to shut down, and as Fergal Hickey pointed out, the vast majority of the spread is coming effectively a spillover from the north and those who are going to work in the likes of Derry. So you have two very different characters in that regard in terms of north and south Donegal, yet the whole place has to be locked down. Now, that's totally understandable in terms of the way we have to break up a thing, but getting buy-in from people in that instance from a place like South Donegal is very difficult. And then in terms of the demographic, people go on about young people. We were all 22 once. I mean, it's a point of your life where there's going to be the most socialisation. It's the point of your life where you're going to live forever. And when the spread is asymptomatic, as so many people have said, getting buy-in from that cohort is just really, really difficult. And I think what's happened up in Donegal in particular highlights the difficulties that we have at this kind of halfway juncture whereby we're not in total lockdown, and at the same time we're asking people, particularly in some areas of the country more than others, to have greater restriction on their movements.
Yeah, I'm just getting a few texts in here. Make older politicians, people, media workers, etc., blaming young people yet again. No mention of the awful public health service older people have created. Another one. I feel that there is too much emphasis on young people spreading the virus to old people. Young people can suffer long COVID and be out of work for 2 to 6 months. I'm 58 and I worry about long COVID in 25-year-olds. That's from Joe Barry in Dublin. It's obvious lots of people, it's a tweet from Fiona, it's obvious lots of people don't care anymore. 50% of us are still doing what's asked, the other 50% are done. Influencers and all the pleading in the world will not change this. Carl, you were trying to get in there.
Yeah, just I would say there's a number of different elements about how we're going to combat this virus, and I think contact tracing is an essential component. I think the service needs to be professionalised, though. I think there's been excellent work over the last 6 months, but a lot of the people employed in that role, they were part-timers.
There was a lot of army people in the role, actually, wasn't
there? Yeah. So the army number one band and a lot of cadets from the Corps were helping out as well. So there was a lot of people who work in speech and language, occupational therapy. Like, I used to meet a lot of dental hygienists in Punchestown and in Newbridge when I visited the hub there. But really, those people have other more important roles to be doing as well. I mean, because a lot of non-COVID morbidity out there needs to be tackled as well. So we really need to have set up a dedicated agency, because COVID is going to be with us and it'll wax and wane for the next 6 months. And we need to have a dedicated agency, because we've all started a job at one stage and you're not good in the first week and you're not good in the second week, but over time you improve.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we did have a dedicated agency, if you just had better data, as you were saying there, Roisin, you would probably be able to get better buy-in. If you were asking people to have to, you know, knuckle down under very tough decisions, if you could actually produce the data to show if you do this, this will happen. Instead, we are making assumptions that we're just saying everywhere the people congregate is probably the cause of it.
Scattergun.
So is that not a huge problem in terms of going into this winter now and the further lockdowns that we might be asking people to endure?
Like, there's no doubt about it. Getting buy-in is a big challenge, particularly with certain cohorts. But I think as well, we need to be careful not to turn on one another. So your texter there that said, well, 50% of us are doing the right thing and the other 50% are not. I think we have to acknowledge that dealing with COVID and the restrictions that have been in place are difficult, more difficult for others than they are for some. And if you look at the breakdown of the data in Dublin, where it showed that where the clusters and the bigger outbreaks were, they were in the more disadvantaged areas of Dublin. So for some people, lockdown was actually a pleasant experience. You had a big garden, time with family. For other people, it was a really difficult experience, very isolating, very lonely, and maybe in a very crowded living conditions as well. So a lot of talk about young people. I think we have to acknowledge that this particular this situation and the pandemic has been really difficult for them. A lot has been taken from young people. Their college experience is going to be completely different. They haven't a chance maybe to meet a new boyfriend or girlfriend, to socialise with their friends, to, like, the pubs and clubs have been closed for the last 6 months. I mean, when I was in my early 20s, that's what I did every weekend. So a lot has been taken from them. And then here we are trying to heap blame on them that, oh, if you're irresponsible, you might kill your grandmother or your grandfather. This level of I think intense debate about young people and their, like, recklessness is not really fair, because we know that gatherings in homes are happening not just at college houses, but people's homes where they're having christenings and communions and other family gatherings. So it's not just people in their 20s. And to get buy-in from that cohort, I think they need to be treated with a level of respect that hasn't really been given, I think.
I think that's an important point, I must say, about now that we've finally got the local area data provided just since last weekend. So we get the figures on a local electoral area basis. And, like, we've been calling for that for a long time, because if you get those local figures, it helps to get buy-in from the public. You can see what's happening in your local community. Mm. And, you know, hopefully you can see then where people pull together and rally around.
I could
the
never
figures.
Understand why that wasn't given, like, at the start, because that seemed to me to be the most obvious thing. If you wanted to explain to people why it's important to do this, it's great to tell them what's happening.
Like, all of that data should be open source. The more information people have, the better.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's no doubt that this is taking a higher toll in areas of disadvantage.
Yeah.
And it has very much exposed then a whole lot of those social problems that we have in terms of overcrowded housing, and you know, poorer incomes and so on. Mm-hmm. But it has also, of course, exposed the massive weaknesses across our public health system that, you know, have been there for many, many years. And indeed also in mental health services, in social care, in nursing homes and all of that, you know, where we have been running services on a shoestring for so many years. And it's like, we have to learn from that. Mm-hmm. And COVID has exposed all of those weaknesses in our public services.
One thing in relation to what Roisin's saying, we have to learn from that. I think I would have been hopeful in the early months of the pandemic that we're going to come out of this differently. But with each passing week, I think that begins to fade, because repeatedly we seem to be doing the same thing over and over again. Not least the whole issue of contact tracing. It would seem that there was no planning for the long term. It would seem that early on, there was no understanding that this was something that was going to be with us for at least a year, and we had to put a long-term infrastructure in place. And I think that's where we're falling down at the moment.
Yeah, I just got, there's a tweet here, quite obvious from Primetime Tonight, that HSE contact tracing and testing is a mess. That's from Anya on Twitter. And that's a story on by Louise Byrne on Primetime Tonight. It's talking about currently having 280 contact tracers. They're hoping to bring that up to 500, but the system is already under strain. The time it takes to contact trace has doubled since the schools reopened. And they had a case study on the programme this evening where a close contact didn't get any call at all from the HSE for, I think, 5 or 6 days after her friend named her as a close contact. And I'm actually hearing a lot of those stories anecdotally of very long gaps. Yes,
Katie, many of the people that were deployed into contact tracing have returned to their substantive posts, because,
which is exactly what Mick was saying, because it wasn't a long term plan.
Exactly, those services need to continue. And I mean, the reality is that, yes, again, this has exposed the kind of threadbare nature of much of our infrastructure. Now, I mean, nobody could have prepared for a coronavirus pandemic in advance of it. But we certainly could have, you know, if it isn't going to be coronavirus, it'll be something else. So we need the capacity to contact trace for things like outbreaks of food poisoning, for meningitis, for many other conditions. So we do need to improve our infrastructure there. And certainly COVID is going to be with us next year and beyond. So we need a long-term strategy to deal with this, which has been sadly lacking.
It's accepted now that, you know, and it was said today, that there's a need for 3,000 people to be working in testing and tracing to do it properly. And, like, it does raise the question, why weren't those people recruited during the summer months when there was a lull, when, you know, the pressure was off? In the last 2 weeks,
has this come up at your parliamentary party meetings, Lisa?
Being honest, the why staff weren't hired in July and August, no, that hasn't come up. I mean, I'm not happy.
Why are we
I'm
only starting happy. To recruit now at this point?
I can't answer the question, Roisin. I'm sorry, I don't have the answers to that. And I'm sorry, I am really worried to hear that people are waiting 5 days to be contacted. Like, that's not acceptable. Like, nobody's justifying that or defending it. And I'm not saying everything's going right. It absolutely isn't. But what I am assured of is that people are trying their best, and it's a really difficult situation. And I think if we start... I suppose fighting with each other
we're told we need 3,000 people, and we haven't done that over the months where the numbers were down, the cases were down. I mean, that's a legitimate question. That's not fighting with each other.
Take that on board, legitimate question. Hiring 3,000 people is a significant, you know, job of work to do. It's not going to happen overnight. But absolutely, I mean, I don't disagree with anyone, what anyone's saying, that if we need extra staff for contact tracing, absolutely.
Okay. There's just one other point I'd make about that. I mean, we accept that everybody in the HSE and in the health service is doing their best. They're under absolutely enormous pressure, trying to, you know, operate a health service that is under-resourced and has been for many years and is inadequate. And on top of that, you have, you know, people trying to deal with COVID and prepare for the future in terms of another surge. I think there's a very strong case for taking the testing and tracing piece away from the HSE and giving it to a dedicated agency that would only be focused
on that.
Pretty
much what you were saying, Carl,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, like, it's something that you can't do part-time.
Yeah.
It needs to be professionalised, and it's actually a skill. I mean, you're doing investigative work there, and you can't just pick that up for a weekend and give it a go. This is a very serious, important job.
I think it's worth saying as well, and I'm not in the government, but I think there's actually a lot of pressure on the government and the different ministries dealing with this on a weekly basis to make these calls, it must be incredibly difficult to have to sit at a meeting and discuss about putting the capital city into more restrictions and discuss what other areas. This is week on week. There's a lot of pressure on people at all levels dealing with this. And I think at a human level, it's difficult for everybody, and they are trying their best on it.
But having said that, Lisa, the model is there in some Western European countries, mm-hmm. and in Asia as well, where they have professionalised the whole business of contact tracing.
That's a good idea. I'm not against it at all. And I think definitely,
I think the
thinking early on was just to deal with it as it was happening. But now that we know, I mean, we're kind of coming to the realisation now that this is going to be, as you said, for the next year, maybe even longer.
But it hasn't been resourced, Lisa. That's the problem. I mean, that's what Nolan said last weekend.
I'm not sure.
Professor Emer Shelley there, yeah. saying she was calling for resources through the summer. She was explaining why they needed them. And I think in terms of resources,
she's probably talking about actual staff, whereas I think in terms of hiring and paying staff isn't the problem. It's actually getting people to do the work. I take that on board, but I'm just saying that it's resources in terms of actually funding this. We are borrowing to try and deal with this, but actually getting staff in place doesn't just happen overnight. It should happen. Okay. It needs to happen. We're not disagreeing on that point.
Okay, look, we'll move on to the next, because we're very smoothly now going to move on to the winter plan, where we'll be talking about resources and staffing all over again, because, of course, today the annual unveiling of the winter plan. This time, we're told, heard more than once today, for a winter like no other. So, Roisin, I know you've been out on this earlier. Give your sense of... is it a curate's egg, good in places?
Well, you know, the headline figure is 600 million, and that's a huge amount of money and dwarfs anything that has ever been kind of provided for a winter plan previously. I think it's important just to dig down a little bit. Out of that 600 million euro, only a third of that is going to be spent this year, and the other two thirds will be next year. The other thing is that a lot of the additional facilities and staffing that have been provided in recent times is included in that. So the number of additional beds, for example, or staff is a lot less than was portrayed in the headlines in this morning's paper.
That's kind of traditional for winter plans, though, isn't it?
Well,
I seem to remember doing this story pretty much every time cover a winter plan.
But I mean, overall, there are points I'd make. I think it's going to be some time till we have the additional hospital beds in place. We know for many years that the number of hospital beds were inadequate. You can't magic them overnight. You can certainly provide modular buildings and get beds up and running in a matter of months, but it's not going to happen in days or weeks. And the planning for this should have taken place sooner, and the funding of it. The other key element, of course, is the additional staffing. Now, they're talking about around 5,000 staff to be recruited between now and the end of the year. Half of those are to be for testing and tracing. The other half are for the health service, the core health service. And when you take into consideration the kind of breadth of the staff that need to be recruited, from home helps to senior consultants, I'd have a question mark over whether that quantum of staff is sufficient at this point. But also, I think there is a real issue within the HSE in terms of very convoluted and complex recruitment systems. And today I called for a fast-track system to be put in place to recruit all of those different categories of staff. Because again, we've known hugely underfunded or understaffed in relation to consultants, in relation to GPs, in relation to all the therapists as well.
Yeah.
And we need to get out recruiting those and get them in post very quickly.
But the overall thrust of this plan is very much in keeping with the thrust of Slow and You Care.
Absolutely,
isn't it?
It's about
keeping people out of those acute beds, trying to get them treated in the community. And so presumably that you'd support the...
Absolutely, increasing the capacity in terms of the physical structures, extra beds in particular, better diagnostics in the community, local treatment centres, all of that kind of thing, and then the additional staff. But that kind of approach of switching activity away from hospitals to the community and providing, enabling people to stay at home, older people with supports and all of that kind of thing, that makes absolute sense. And that is exactly what Slow and You Care was about. It's just a pity we're 3 years late starting that now.
Okay. Fergal.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we would welcome this wholeheartedly. Anything that will make the lot of the patients who come through emergency departments, and particularly those who require hospital admission, often very significantly ill, we would welcome. I think I would agree with Roisin on absolutely everything she has said. I mean, I'm also concerned that there's not a lot of detail in this. So, for example, it talks about 892 additional acute beds and says that 409 of them have already been provided. I see no evidence of that provision, and there's no clarity as to where those additional beds will be provided. And likewise, when you talk about additional ICU beds, they talk about 17 additional beds, but I think they're part of the acute bed number that they reference. But remember that as long ago as 2009, the prospectus report done at the time showed that we had 289 ICU beds and recommended that we would have 418 by 2010 and 579 by 2020. And that was before there was a COVID pandemic. So we're starting from a very low base. There isn't a lot of detail in this, although the direction of travel I would agree with. When we talk, for example, about alternatives to emergency departments and diagnostics for GPs, all that is fine, but we don't have the current diagnostic capability to provide hospital diagnostics. So there has to be a significant ramping up of diagnostics all around to facilitate this. I mean, there are some good and sensible things in it. For example, the statement, the kind of categorical statement that emergency department crowding is simply a symptom of the long-standing capacity problem is important, because people have often tried to solve this by going at the wrong end of the problem. Also, the fact that
can I just ask you about that one, Fergal?
Yes.
As you face into this winter now, I know when this hit last March, April, when COVID hit us, there was a lot of talk about how all the trolleys that we were so used to seeing in all our emergency departments seemed to disappear. Nobody was going near the hospitals, and we got worried then about people not turning up for legitimate complaints at hospitals. Are you worried now, as we are where we now, the end of September, of what you are facing into in terms of overcrowding in your emergency department as you also try and deal with a pandemic?
Genuinely worried. And we have had significant crowding. We had particularly significant crowding last week. It's a little bit better this week, but it's still unacceptably bad. Our problem in Sligo, and I can speak definitively about that, is we're short of capacity. We're short about 40 beds. There's a proposal sitting on the Minister for Health, the previous Minister for Health's desk for the last 2 years, which hasn't been acted upon, even though we've planning permission. So, you know, things move incredibly slowly. And we are always being given hope that the problem will be resolved, but the devil will be in the detail. And I'd be interested to see, if we look back at this plan, how much of it's actually implemented. I mean, it is scary. We effectively have to provide two parallel emergency departments. We have to provide an emergency department for those with lightly COVID and those that might have COVID on the one hand, and an area for those that we think are highly unlikely to have COVID, who come with normal things such as broken bones, lacerations that need suturing, the normal routine mundane stuff. And the challenge for us is that as more and more asymptomatic COVID is out there, we will have people who will infect other people by virtue of being asymptomatic. And we're doing this in what is essentially very poor infrastructure.
There's another issue there, Katie. I mean, the whole staffing thing, I just can't envisage how that is going to be fulfilled. To a certain extent, even, because so much of the health service is reliant on people coming here from overseas.
Yeah, the figure,
and whether that's
yeah,
going to be available.
Just to give you that stat, 49% of the nurses we recruited last year were non-nationals.
Yeah, and is that route into the country going to be available? Are people going to be willing to travel? What are the implications in terms of the whole COVID? I mean, that alone, and that's only one aspect of the problems with recruitment, and it's very hard to see where that's going to come from. One other element to it, and you know, this movement towards the Sláinte Care blueprint, and particularly services in the community, it's nearly as if we're getting there by default, that because the pandemic is here and there's a greater emphasis on keeping people out of hospital, we're moving in that direction.
But are we moving in two directions at once? Because one of the other elements of this plan is because there isn't the capacity for that diagnostic work in the public service, we're actually going to end up buying a lot of that from the private hospitals, which is where we were supposed to be moving away from.
Completely. And then you have to ask, when hopefully next year, hopefully at some stage, when we get past all this, are we going to go back to firefighting then, or are they going to push forward and finally try and implement Sláinte Care? Which, remember, if we had started down this road 3 years ago, how better placed would we be now to deal with the current circumstances?
Yeah, Cathal, this is your area as well.
Yeah, so basically, look, is it a perfect plan? Of course not. Will it help? It certainly will. As Roisin was saying, 600 million is a big headline figure. It's 15 times bigger than last year's winter plan. But the devil is in the detail, and it's all about implementation. What I do like in the plan is the free vaccination programme for seasonal influenza for at-risk groups. I think that's good. I do like the provision of PPE, over €1 billion in PPE. And then also, I suppose the problem I would have with it is from a diagnostics perspective, that there is capacity and spare capacity in our public hospitals from a diagnostics perspective. Like the machines are there, the MRIs, the CT machines, the ultrasounds, the x-rays, but the people aren't there at night and the people aren't there at weekends. And if we can get staff to actually man those diagnostic machines after hours, it'll make a big difference in relation to hospital capacity.
Yeah, Lisa.
Carl, can I speak to that issue? I think there's a presumption that the machines are unused because the system wants them to be unused, which I think is wrong. So, I mean, I'm a consultant in emergency medicine. I regularly request advanced imaging CT scans out of hours. But that requires a radiographer to be called in for that, and it requires an on-call radiologist to review the images. The system has been set up to provide a 9-to-5 service, and it was set up at a time in which there was very little activity out of hours. Now there's a significant amount of activity out of hours without the necessary increase in staffing. We, in general, are short of radiologists, we're short of radiographers. There's really no point in having the machine if you don't have the technician who's capable of using it and somebody to look at the images. So, you know, this issue comes up on a regular basis, but we need to address, you know, if we're going to deal with the capacity, we need to make sure there's the people there to provide the service. And that has always been left out of these plans. The fact that there is a reference in this year's winter plan is unusual. I think I've endured at this stage a dozen winters, started as winter initiatives, then they became winter plans. In general, nothing tends to improve during the winter in spite of much fanfare. It's interesting that in the introduction to the document, it actually states categorically that in spite of so-called improvements, the numbers of people on trolleys has gone up consistently year on year, 2016 to 17 to 18 to 19. So, I mean, this is a major step up in terms of the resource they're putting into it. But I worry about the actual delivery of it. I don't think the people are there to provide the service. I don't think they'll be able to get people in. To take McClifford's point, I don't see people coming from abroad into Ireland because, first of all, it's almost impossible to get here now because there are so many flights cancelled. People are scared. There's quarantine regulations, legitimate ones. I just don't think people are going to come to this country. So we're going to have to find other ways of staffing this. We're going to have to grow our own talent. We're going to have to increase the number of people that we're training and recognise that there'll be a hiatus before they're actually trained.
Yeah, I just want to put that to Lisa because, you know, it's not just Fergal Hickey who's saying that. SIPTU are saying it today. The INMO are saying it. Nursing Homes Ireland are saying the HSC are so desperate for staff that they're coming poaching their staff, which is a very serious situation, you know, after the last 6 months we've been through. There is a huge credibility gap here in terms of where those staff are going to be found and recruited from.
Yeah, so it's just to, I suppose, start by saying there seems to be kind of broad enough welcome, I would suggest, across the political spectrum, that this is, in terms of what's on the paper, is good, that it's a significant, €600 million is huge money for a winter plan. I think everybody accepts that. There's a lot of good things in the plan as well. I think the flu vaccinations is a really positive thing, because obviously flu with COVID, the two together is what we're really worried about. You know, but I fully accept that the government will be judged on delivery. I'm the same with everybody else. I'm, you know, we've been here before year on year, and like the health service is in bad shape in lots of areas, and it's not going to get fixed overnight. And I'd like to see launch of care. I wish it started 3 years ago, and it didn't. So we're all
Why
on.
Not, Lisa?
Well, I wasn't in government. I was in opposition with you, Shoshin.
So your partner was.
No, we weren't actually
involved for the last 3 years in supporting a government.
Well,
we
can twist things whatever we want to. But we weren't in government, and I wasn't in government. And my point is that I wish.
But all parties
and
need
I'm
to
agreeing,
make Sláinte Care a priority.
But I'm saying that. I'm actually agreeing with you. I'm saying that I'm, and I, all I said is that I was sorry that it hadn't started sooner. But in terms of the winter plan, yes, it's very ambitious. There's huge money been put into it. In terms of the staffing and the nurses, I don't know what's going to happen with that. I mean, if, as Cathal said, there's difficulties. Fergal had said that there's difficulties with people travelling into the country. I mean, that's a very reasonable thing to say, actually. So I don't have an answer on that. But yes, we need more nurses. And I mean, I would suggest that we probably need to start looking at nurses' pay and conditions and, you know, to try and attract people back into the sector. And I wasn't aware of the issue of the HSE poaching nurses. I mean, that's not acceptable. And if they are doing that, I would.
And Nursing Homes Ireland put out a statement today.
So if that's happening again, I don't agree with that. But we will be judged on delivery on this. I can't predict what will happen at the end of it. I hope. And I'm hopeful that maybe with the mask wearing and the washing of hands and the social distancing, that maybe the flu won't take as much of a hold as it might have done other years. That obviously for all of our frontline workers, my mother is one of them. She works in the local hospital in Mayo. So for her and everyone else's family members working on the front line, I sincerely hope that what's in this plan comes to fruition, that it is successful, that we have enough capacity and that we get through this winter and keep people safe.
Fergal, can I just ask you, are you a fan of Sláinte Care?
I think it's a direction of travel. I absolutely am committed to the logic that as much care in the community that can be provided in the community is provided in the community. But I find sometimes that its greatest advocates seem to forget that there is still a very significant role for hospitals. And I look at the patients on trolleys in my emergency department every day. And I often ask myself the question, could these patients be dealt with in the community? And the answer in many occasions is no. We've moved from a situation where somebody had a single chronic disease, which could be managed in primary care and could be managed very well in primary care, to seeing more and more people who have multiple comorbidities and incredibly complex comorbidities. And they require hospital care. And clearly, those that need surgical intervention, those that, you know, need emergency surgical intervention, that's always going to be done in hospital. So it's not that I'm not a fan of Sláinte Care, but I do think that some of the assumptions about it are overly ambitious. And particularly when you look at the bed capacity report, it makes a lot of assumptions about the impact Sláinte Care will have on the number of beds needed, which I don't think will be realised. I mean, I would like to see it realised. I mean, I would like to be in a position that for the balance of my career, that we're not struggling with people on trolleys, which has been the position for the last 15 years. And I would love to see Sláinte Care being successful in that regard. But I am somewhat sceptical about the claims for what it will achieve. I think it will achieve a lot. I just don't think it will achieve as much as its proponents would suggest.
I'll just put that to one of its proponents.
Sure. Well, as you say, the main thrust is to switch activity from acute hospitals to the community, and that's the best place for people to receive most of their care. And we know that chronic illness accounts for, you know, 70 to 80% of activity. So if we can deal with chronic illness in a preventative way, but also also early management of it in the community, then it does downstream take a lot of pressure off. But of course, it is based on the delivery of the bed capacity review that showed that we would need at least 2,500 additional hospital beds. They haven't been provided. And the other key thing, of course, about Sláintecare is that the intention is to remove cost as a barrier to everybody being able to access care, because too many people go without adequate care, and it is a huge driver of inequality in our society.
Yeah. Carl, you've been trying to get in.
Just two, I suppose, constructive points as best I can, Katie. The first one is that the HSE has a database of 72,000 volunteers. These are the people who volunteered back in March during the first wave of the crisis. Now, they've only employed about 120 or 130 of those people. So it's a huge reservoir of people there, untapped resource, and that should be the first port of call from a volunteering perspective. Now, are they radiologists? Are they high-end nurses? Probably not a lot, but you could certainly get 1,500 contact traces out of there, and I think that would be a very good way of expediting the process. They've already filled up the forms.
Just on that, we got an email in while we were on air. I and lots of others put our names down to do contact tracing. We were not taken on. The problem is that recruitment and management of contact tracing should have been done by someone other than the HSE, a separate agency. That's from Elaine Howley. So I wonder how many more Elaines are out there in relation
absolutely,
to
it. Absolutely. We should capitalise on that wonderful volunteer spirit. People are keen to work.
I wonder if that volunteer spirit is a bit crushed, actually. If you had, you know, packed up all your bags, come home from Australia, got onto the HSE, said, here I am, I'm qualified, I'm willing to do it, and you're still waiting for the phone to ring. I think your volunteer spirit might be taking a bit of a hammering now.
Yeah. Just, I suppose, my last, I guess, positive point would be in relation to the seasonal flu situation. So Australia and New Zealand, traditionally, they're just coming out of their winter now. And just the trends we're getting from Australia and New Zealand is that the seasonal flu has probably only been as 20% as bad as it was in previous years. And the reason being is that the COVID precautions that are taking place in New Zealand.
Well, I'm glad to hear.
Yeah. So, I mean, we can finish on a positive. So hopefully, again, there's no guarantee of this, that the trends we're seeing from a seasonal flu perspective in Ireland over the next few months will be somewhat diminished, which is a positive at least.
We might have Christmas after all.
Oh, here's another one. We have an email saying that a listener's son qualified with experience in contact tracing and was told that the HSE are only recruiting internally. So, okay, I do think that contact tracing piece is not going to go anywhere. I think we're going to be returning to it again and again.
The point you made there, Katie, though, was made this morning by Phil Nihay of the INMO, who was saying about the large number of nurses that came back to Ireland to volunteer for Ireland's call. And, you know, they expected to be offered secure jobs and permanent jobs in the HSE, and they were referred to agencies instead. Mm. And like we're spending 1.2 million euro a week on agencies. It's this lack of joined up thinking and forward planning that has dogged the health service.
But it's not just that, though, isn't it? People are referred to agencies because the HSE doesn't want to take on all the other responsibilities that come with having to actually hire somebody on the payroll. We don't have much time left. I did want to go to you, Mick, and that story you had on, it wasn't your story, but it was on the front page of your paper this morning about the poultry processors, Manor Farm, charging their staff for PPE.
It's unbelievable. Like, I mean, we've got to that stage in an area where we have seen there's been a huge volume of outbreaks where people are most vulnerable. They're living in cramped conditions, and to turn around and charge them for PPE. The fact it can still be allowed is the really disturbing thing. And where do you go with something like that?
Yeah, Lisa.
I read it. I initially think, is this some sort of a joke or something? I mean, they say their justification, if you can even call it that, was that we've been doing this for ages and we actually refund it if they stay long enough. I mean, I thought they just weren't getting the message that this is just wrong in every regard. It doesn't matter if you've been doing it for ages or not. But certainly, I hope that they've changed that policy, having seen the response from the wider public.
Okay, and as I say, another couple of minutes left, and because I have you here, Lisa, I want to ask about the Brexit and the hauliers and that Landbridge issue.
Well, Brexit hasn't gone away. We know we got a break because we were focused elsewhere, but the Landbridge poses a serious problem for us. And
but what has been going on down in Rosslare? Has there been work going to try and give Irish hauliers an alternative route onto mainland Europe?
Like, Rosslare definitely needs more investment, and it's a fantastic additional, I suppose, resource for us, because Dublin, you know, there's a limited capacity in Dublin Port. It's doing great work there. I've visited the port on a number of occasions, and it's actually a sight to behold. So yes, Rosslare needs further investment, but it's not going to save us from the queues that we will face if Brexit goes badly come January 1st. Rosslare is not going to be at the capacity we need it to be to take all of the traffic that would normally go through the land bridge. So that's not going to fix it for us. And, you know, let's be under no illusion that if Irish trucks are heading to Dover and there's queues, we will not be prioritised over English trucks. And Michael Gove's comments that were leaked out to the media recently, where he said that, you know, worst case scenario, 30 to 50% of their hauliers are not ready for this, and that they could see thousands of trucks backed up queuing around Dover. And they're now going to have a licensing system to stop you even entering the vicinity of the port, and that you'll be fined if you do so. So the short answer to this is that come January 1st, we just can't replace the land bridge overnight. We will still need to use it to some extent. Yes, we need direct access straight to mainland Europe. Rosslare is the obvious point to start developing further, but it will have an impact on supply chains. So I really hope we can get a deal over the line. We'd actually debated in the Shannons last night the issue of Brexit and the internal markets bill that's putting additional pressure on the potential for a no deal, because now they want to breach the withdrawal agreement.
But sure, I mean, if you're dealing with people who are willing to, you know, announce to the world that they are willing to breach an international treaty that they signed less than a year ago, can you really rely on any arrangement we can come to with the UK in relation to that land bridge? Surely, should you just full steam ahead to get an alternative route now for our hauliers?
Absolutely. I mean, I think a fair question to ask. Nobody could have foresaw that the UK would quite openly say we intend to breach international law. I think it just flummoxed everybody. The idea that the law...
I think hauliers are going to be wondering, why haven't we done more about the alternatives then?
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot has happened. I don't think it's enough. I don't think we can replace the land bridge overnight. And I'm genuinely concerned come January as to what's going to happen. I mean, the land bridge will still be available. They have signed up to the Common Transit Convention. We can still travel through the UK and not have additional checks to get our stuff through to get onto the EU soil, the far side. So we can still use it. But expect delays. Okay. Expect delays.
Okay. I'm going to have to take this break, but stay with us after this.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And I just have time for one last text before we go. Katie, we own a nursing home and are losing three nurses to the HSE in the next month. All three have been given this contract and start date in the last week. So Lisa can be absolutely assured that this is happening, unfortunately. So that's going to become a serious issue, I think, as we go into the next few weeks. That's all we have time for. I want to thank my panel here and in Sligo and in Tamik down the corridor. And that's all we have time for this week. Tonight's programme was produced by Caroline Dalton, research was by Andrew Fleming, the broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Gar Duffy was on sound. And now it's over to Colin Murray on Late Date.